Welcome to Wrap'em Focus, a podcast devoted to exploring the provocative and impactful aspects of the research published in Regional Anesthesia and Pain Medicine. Here, we'll make sure to discuss and debate the findings that matter most for clinicians, patients, and policymakers. I'm Brian Seitz, Editor-in-Chief. I am an anesthesiologist and professor at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. At Wrap'em, we believe well-done pain medicine improves health and well-being. I'll work to keep the discussion relevant and factual. Thanks for joining us. Let's get started. About 30% of my clinical decisions when I am on our acute pain medicine service revolve around adjudicating anticoagulation issues. In fact, I know a lot of people nowadays who really don't want to even do regional anesthesia because they're worried about conflicting with bleeding concerns and bleeding risks. So thank goodness for the app. That's a real plug for Azure Pain. They've done an amazing job with that. I use that every day. However, it often comes down to a semi-quantitative risk-benefit assessment between bleeding and the advantages of a regional block. For instance, we will often perform a surgical ankle block on a fully anticoagulated patient for a toe amp because we believe that the risks of the bleeding are less than the potential benefits for the patient. In general, more information about anticoagulants is always an interesting topic for our readers. This is why Wrap'em was so delighted to support the work of Dr. Daryl Henshaw and Dr. Chris Edwards. Dr. Henshaw did his medical school residency and regional anesthesia and acute pain fellowship training at Wake Forest. He is the associate vice chair of clinical operations at HRM Wake Forest Baptist Health and section head of regional anesthesia and acute pain management and the medical director of acute pain services. Dr. Edwards is a graduate of LSU Health Sciences in Wake Forest for both anesthesia and fellowship training in Wrap'em. He is the medical director for regional anesthesia and acute pain. So Daryl and Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
Man, it's our pleasure, Brian.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation.
Dr. Henshaw and colleagues performed a prospective trial where they asked the question if current guidelines to hold full anticoagulation dose of Lovenox for 24 hours before surgery resulted in adequate anti-10A level activity to support the performance of neuraxial or deep anesthetic type nerve block procedures. Patients were randomized to either a 24-hour group, the last dose at 7 a.m. the day prior to surgery, or a 36-hour group, the last dose at 7 p.m. 2 days prior to surgery. Upon arrival for surgery, blood samples were obtained to assess residual anti-10A level activity and renal function. The primary outcome was residual anti-10A level activity following the last treatment dose. So to start things off, can you tell us how you got the idea to investigate this topic? Did you have specific clinical experiences that may have led you to question whether or not the guidelines were perhaps too liberal?
Yeah, Brian, I'll go ahead and take that one. Our first publication was actually in Wrap'em related to anti-10A level residual activity after treatment dose and enoxaparin use in 2017. Some of the same authors wrote a daring discourse. And in that situation, we published the results of 19 patients. And that was just because we had clinical concern. We had patients who would often show up right at 24 hours or near it. And we were trying to figure out, are we okay based on the current published guidelines to proceed? What if the patients are elderly? What if the patients have, decreased renal function? And surprisingly, when we started to use the anti-10A levels to try to help guide some clinical decision-making, we were actually shocked at the number of times it would come back elevated. The thing we weren't sure at the time was what really levels kind of constitute being elevated. Zero is zero. We always felt pretty comfortable if there was no residual effect, but 0.1, 0.2, 0.5, we weren't really sure. And we stated that very clearly in the discourse that we chose 0.2 international units per ml as the cutoff, at least in our mind. But that's a big question that we still don't know the answer to. Following the publication of that study, we started working on a larger, more prospective study to get more detail and get a little more granularity. And so that study that you're referring to now has been ongoing for the last few years as we tried to answer some of those questions.
And what's really cool about this, and I know we went back and forth a little bit during the review process, which I always find very enriching, and I hope you guys did too, is that your study, you know, like on face value seems really simple. It's just, okay, we're going to have these two groups and we're going to see how things play out. But actually, your study is really complex. For instance, patients may or may not stop their Lovenox exactly at the time specified. Moreover, surgical start times, I know this is shocking, may vary patient to patient and day to day and surgeon to surgeon, right? So as such, you can see how this like great organized research plan could have a lot of variability in it. And yet we had to take that into account, and you did too. I'm just kind of curious to get your kind of thoughts now that the project's all done and published, kind of what you went through. And I like this because it's actually a real world example of how hard it is to do research and how we don't live in in isolation in a research lab.
Yeah, I think if you look at the study, Brian, you know, it's easy to make an assumption that almost every patient, a large majority of the patients, just failed their protocol. And in reality, we designed it because we knew that they would. We knew, based on our typical clinical approach, is that we never know when a patient is going to arrive for surgery 2 weeks from now. That's really dependent on the surgical schedulers or somebody outside of my bandwidth to tell people when they should be here. And so what we always do is we say, well, if you might have surgery at 7 a.m. on the earliest, I don't want you to have these drugs for 24 hours. So by default, you take it the morning before and hopefully before 7 o'clock. As you know, patients oversleep. They oftentimes get confused. They don't remember. They say the morning or the nighttime. And we knew that variability was actually going to be helpful because ultimately, at the end of the day, we just wanted data from a lot of different patients. But having them occur at different time points was actually the intention all along.
Yeah, no, I your summary of all those characteristics made me think about a case when I was a resident out a long, long time ago, where the practice of the orthopedic surgeon was to give the patient before their total joint arthroplasty a prescription for Coumadin, so that it was easy on the discharge period that the surgeon didn't have to write for it again. And he prescribed Coumadin, you know, to this patient to be filled postoperatively, but gave it to him preoperatively. And an elderly patient started taking Coumadin for, you know, basically a week before the knee replacement. And of course, this is all unknown to us until there was a bleeding problem, you know, at some point during their course, and like an INR was checked and it was like, you know, it was like 7 or something. And then of course all the investigative aspects of it came out and we figured out what happened. But that's the real world. You don't hand a prescription to, you know, let's say an elderly patient and or any patient assume they're going to follow the rules for weeks before surgery. But I just thought that was kind of like an interesting kind of story. It was a very, very long time ago. But in terms of this actual study itself, you originally characterized it as a randomized controlled trial. And then some kind of interesting, you know, back and forth happened when we went through the peer review process. You know, our sense, and I think you finally kind of agreed with us, that this is more of a very elaborate observational data set, because in a true randomized controlled trial, you would analyze patients as an intention to treat, essentially, and you would have to take all these time periods that were not accurate in terms of stopping the Lovenox and then analyze them as if they were. And that was going to be problematic because of how much deviation from the actual group assignment they were. So do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because I actually want to use this, and I think I told you this, I want to use this as an example in Journal Club about, you know, characteristics of an RCT versus observational data.
Yeah, you know, so I guess I'd be remiss, Brian, if I didn't give some of the design credit to both Robert Weller, who was the former section head at Wake Forest, now retired, and Dr. James Eisenach, who's, I think many people who are involved in research are going to know his name from anesthesiology for a long time. And they both helped me think through this as, you know, early in my career as a more junior faculty member, you know, trying to wrap your head around some different approaches to how we do research, you know, can be complex. And so fortunately, their mentorship allowed us as a group to come up with what I think is a, you know, pretty unique design to a study. You know, I think when we first started this whole thing, in my mind, we randomized people. So it's randomized trial. And I really don't know, and you can correct me if you know better than I do, if there are that many randomized observational trials out there. And so I think this is kind of a novel way to look at something, especially when the ultimate goal is to figure out what best practice might be, and it might differ from current recommendations. And then also, okay, well, we need to collect lab work at various time points, but we only have access to these patients for a very short window.
Yeah, I think that's the best way to characterize it. I think we did that in the paper, you know, helping you, and you ultimately, I think, got the language just perfectly. It's a randomized observational trial, and I don't think there's a lot. What comes to mind, and I don't know if you've heard of the study design called REMAP. It's kind of fancy. It's called Randomized Embedded Multifactorial Adaptive Platform Design, and REMAP. And basically, it's the idea is it's point of care randomization event that happens within the EMR, electronic medical record, and then the whole health system does what it normally does. But it basically is just a randomized event. And this reminded me of that because you essentially did what you normally do. Patients come in at various times. Nursing communicates to patients in the normal way. But the reality is it doesn't match exactly with what group they were assigned to. So no, I think it's fascinating and I think it's super interesting. And I love the fact that you chose us to publish it. So, but before we get into your findings, I want to make sure, Chris, do you have any thoughts that you want to share? Because I haven't heard from you yet.
Yeah, well, the big thing I wanted to say is I think your insights on how to describe the study are both correct, but also more importantly, I think it adds to kind of the beauty of the study design, and that not only is, you know, medical research can be very time consuming and very challenging, especially in the context of a clinical workday. This study and its design allowed us to collect data in real time, as it would normally occur in clinical practice, and gave us a very robust, kind of diversified data set to really build the linear regression model. And I think it was just a very eloquent design to facilitate this kind of research and actually give you useful information. And so I think your characterization is great. And I think it also probably makes the data more applicable, in that you're not trying to put it in these categories where, you know, okay, that's a protocol violation. We need to pull that data set out.
Yeah, or analyze it kind of in a way that doesn't really reflect what it is by the kind of normal standards of how you do like a regular RCT. Now, in terms of anti-10A levels, can you tell us a little bit about how they're measured, how they correlate with bleeding, and how you specifically picked your threshold? I know you mentioned it was a somewhat arbitrary, but presumably it was grounded in some connection to something that may suggest bleeding risk.
Yeah, I'll let Chris in a moment talk about kind of how we check anti-10A levels and kind of what goes into that. But, you know, if you look at a large portion of the anticoagulation anti-10A literature, usually surrounding enoxaparin, it seems to be pretty well agreed upon that when you check peak levels, so these would be levels checked roughly 4 to 6 hours after the dose is administered. If you're on a prophylactic dose, which would be 40 once a day, 40 milligrams once a day, or 30 milligrams twice a day, the aim for your peak value is somewhere between 0.2 and 0.5. For peak levels related to a treatment dose, whether it's a milligram per kilo once a day or 1.5 milligrams per kilo, twice or versus once a day, anything over 0.5 and somewhere up to 0.8 or 1 is your peak target range for treatment. And so we just kind of used our clinical, just good common sense and said, okay, if the bottom of the target zone for prophylaxis is 0.2, and anything at 0.2 or above is going to prevent you from making a DVT in your leg, in theory, it should keep you from making a blood clot in your back, which could lead to a hematoma. And so we just said anything below 0.2 in our minds probably fell into the range of being safer. Now, whether or not, Brian, at the end of the day, you know, when hopefully some other people follow up on my research or we continue to do what we've been doing, hopefully we can kind of correlate, well, is 0.2 still too elevated for a spinal anesthetic or an epidural? And is 0.1 better? Does it need to be 0, or is there something in between? And unfortunately, some of the assays don't really go out to that second or third decimal point. So you get stuck with less than 0.1, but I don't know if it's 0.08 or if it's 0.01. And we had to take that into account with the way we analyze some of our data too. So we chose 0.2 and we felt like we had a good rational reason for why. The piece that's missing, I think you alluded to, is how do we correlate a level to the bleeding risk? And I think that's a study that still needs to be done. Another complicated study to figure out how to compare blood loss intraoperatively or procedurally with known levels of anti-10A level activity at baseline, you know, when the surgery starts. But I think it's going to be a big study. So, Chris, you want to talk about the assay?
Yeah. I mean, I'll definitely start by saying I am definitely not an expert by any means on lab-based techniques. But my understanding is that most commonly these anti-10A assays are chromogenic in nature. Essentially, what we're doing is we're taking a citrated platelet poor plasma mixture from the patient and adding it to a known quantity of factor 10A. That low molecular weight heparin antithrombin complex then inactivates that factor 10A. And basically, we use a standardized curve that is constructed for that particular assay through, I guess, dilutional processes of low molecular weight heparin or sometimes combination of heparin and low molecular weight heparin to develop kind of a normalized plasma curve. And then you can compare the degree of anti-10A effect as kind of a basis for comparison, is my understanding of it.
Yeah, I think the thing that's interesting, Brian, is it's really important, I think, for other clinicians if they're going to start ordering heparin assays or anti-10A assays at their institution, is they need to have a conversation with pathology and whoever's in charge of their lab. Because the anti-10A curve that's used in the laboratory to tell you what the residual level is specific to each anti-10A drug, which means you can't run, you know, rivaroxaban on a curve that's designed around an enoxaparin. The number is going to be meaningless. And so we needed to know before we started any of this that what we actually use is a hybrid curve that is allowed to be used for both heparin and enoxaparin. And I think designing those curves, and they're out there for all these other different drugs, but the same question still remains about our other, you know, more novel oral anti-10A medications is what's an acceptable residual level? And there's a lot of questions around that could still be answered as well.
Yeah. Now, so you're kind of trailblazing in your picking of the reference point, which is kind of cool. It could be like a legacy thing as if it's proven to be, you know, just where it needs to be. But presumably the people that worked on the guidelines for ASRA must have had some rationale. Do you know off the top of your head what their, you know, like 24-hour time period was based on?
Yeah, my understanding is that a lot of that information is not publicly available. I did actually reach out to some of the original authors for the ASRA guidelines. And to be honest with you, they weren't able to give me a lot more information on kind of how they decided that time point was appropriate. My assumption is it's based on the pharmacokinetics of the drug.
It's based on the half-life.
And they may have had some residual anti-10A level data that, you know, is not maybe easily obtained. The interesting part is, Brian, you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I'm assuming the next generation of ASRA guidelines will be coming out at some point in the near future, hopefully. But up until this most current version, and including the most current version, the ASRA guidelines actually don't recommend testing anti-10A level activity routinely. And their rationale is just like we talked about. Nobody knows what level is safe to proceed. And so telling people clinically what they may want to base their clinical judgment on, I don't think has been an easy decision.
Right. And that's why, you know, I love your line of work because it's a little bit provocative and trailblazing. So now the fun part of the discussion, you want to share kind of your kind of key findings in terms of the primary outcome of the anti-10A levels?
Yeah. I mean, I think our primary outcome is really that to have 95% confidence that the residual anti-10A level is below what we consider the lower therapeutic level of 0.2 international units per milliliter. At least on our results, suggests that you probably need to be waiting more on the order of around 31 and a half hours, which suggests that a more conservative period of abstinence is probably warranted as compared to the current guidelines.
And that's kind of like a mic drop moment, isn't it?
Yeah, we suspected that was probably going to happen. We weren't sure where that intersect of the line or where the 95% confidence bounds would fall. You know, and the last study with 19 patients, 11 of them had elevated levels. So we were suspicious that we were probably going to find out, you know, but we wanted to go into it objectively. Our hypothesis was that it would be greater than 24 hours with exactly where that line would be. Just to give you the full data set, we ended up with 103 patients. We had 52 in one group and 51 in the other. We enrolled 122, but as expected, some of them either did not arrive for surgery for a variety of reasons. Surgery was canceled. COVID impacted our study where we shut down elective surgeries, and that certainly changed our access to patients. But the intersect of the line where our best fit function, our linear regression, passed through the 0.2 intersect is 28.25 hours. And we rounded that to the nearest quarter hour just to make the math simple. The upper bounds of the 95% confidence interval, which is what we said would be highly reliable at that point, 95% of people should meet that metric, was, like Chris said, 31 and a half hours.
Yep. That seems like an important piece of information to me. Now, I loved how you looked at the odds of success as another kind of analysis in terms of success being defined as below the threshold. Do you want to share that odds assessment?
Yeah. So based on some of our prior publication, which again was pretty small with only 19 people, there at least was some, you know, sense that maybe elderly female patients who had at least mild or moderate levels of renal insufficiency may be at risk of elevated anti-10A levels at and after 24 hours. So we looked at age, we looked at sex, and we looked at renal function as calculated both by Cockcroft and Gall formula and then a modified version that's been out there. And we also then looked at BMI just to make sure, you know, is a higher BMI and a bigger dose of drug, is that associated? And really, when you take them all together, Ryan, age in general, odds ratio was not significantly different. Sex did not impact the odds of having an elevated anti-10A level. And neither did renal function as calculated by the entire groups, regardless of which formula you used. BMI also was not a predictive factor. Interestingly, female sex presenting at less than 24 hours was associated with an increased odds ratio that was significant for patients to have residual anti-10A level activity that's above 0.2.
And what would be the biological foundation for that, though?
You know, Brian, it's interesting. I think it's been a little while, and I apologize for that. But the package insert for enoxaparin actually does suggest that gender might impact levels. While they do suggest that you would need to dose adjust for anybody with a creatinine clearance less than 30, they recommend that there's no dose adjustments for people with a creatinine clearance that's greater than that. But, you know, it makes intuitive sense based on the way we metabolize and clear the drug that even mild or moderate renal function may impact your residual levels. Female gender, I can't speculate exactly why that is, other than maybe there's something else with the renal function combination, body size for those patients that impacted their ability to clear the drug at 24 hours.
But I think it's a good general consideration that if someone has significant renal failure, you should think about the possibility that the blood levels of the drug are higher, just as a principle. Would you agree with that, though?
Yeah, I think, elderly patients, female patients, and anybody with moderate or more severe renal insufficiency, those are the ones that, for us clinically, we still have, you know, this sense that that's the patient I'm probably most worried about. And if they're near 24 hours or even somewhere closer to 25, 28 or 30 hours out from their last dose, and we have time, I mean, at our institution, it takes usually less than 15 minutes to get the results of the anti-10A assay back. And then you got to figure out what to do with it. But like you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, it allows us to have a risk-benefit conversation amongst ourselves and including our patients to come up with a, hey, your level's 0.2 or it's 0.1 or it's 0.3, but your risk of general anesthesia for this case, in my opinion, is much higher. Here's the risk, but we need to monitor you neurologically postoperatively because we think you're going to have an elevated potential risk of a hematoma.
Yeah, well stated. And I'm interested in both of your thoughts on the implications for policy, because your findings may have impact on clinical practice. What do you think? Do you kind of favor changes to the next version of the guidelines? And kind of curious how that all looks to you.
Yeah, I'd like to think we've got way more information now, Brian, than we had, 5 years ago. And there's also was another study that came out in the last couple of years, retrospectively looking at very similar to what we did with our first study, but just on a little larger scale, which also suggested some concern with the 24-hour mark. Interestingly, the European Society guidelines that came out recently actually suggest that any level less than 0.1 would be safe to proceed. That's the first time, as far as I know, any of the American or European guidelines have suggested an actual cutoff point. It's interesting because in our study, had we used 0.1, we would have been almost at 48 hours before we got that 95% confidence interval to cross.
Yeah, it's like I bet like the 0.2 is equivalent to an INR of like 1.5. You don't know what quite to do with it, 1.4, 1.5. What do you think, Chris?
I think for me, there's a lot of questions that would like to have more answers to. Like specifically when you talk about, abstinence from someone's anticoagulation therapy, you're always balancing the risk of hematoma formation or bleeding from the procedure, but also the risk of DVT formation in the interim period before they actually had that surgical procedure or you resume their anticoagulation. So for me, I think, some of the questions I'd like to see answered in the future are, at what anti-10A level are we concerned that your risk of DVT formation is increasing or at that at-risk point? And then conversely, at what anti-10A level are we concerned that you're actually at increased risk for procedural hematoma or procedural blood loss? And that still kind of remains to be seen. We've used the 0.2 as kind of a surrogate marker as the lower cutoff for the therapeutic dosing range, the prophylactic dosing range. But really, those are the questions in my mind that the little nitty gritty details I would like to see answered to kind of further help us delineate, how we should be managing these patients.
And I think your point about considering why the person's on the anticoagulation is really, really important, and that we do have a very good plan B, right, in anesthesia. So it's not usually a big deal to kind of pull the plug and say we're gonna not do a regional anesthetic because we have, ERAS protocols, we have balanced general anesthetics, we have TEVAs. It's not as good often in terms of the pain management, but they are good options. So you always have to factor that. If you had no other options, then you'd be kind of stuck.
Yeah. And Brian, I think there is good data out there, at least in some of the surgical and trauma literature, that, trough ranges during enoxaparin use, when you get down below 0.1, the risk of DVTs and PEs do go up. So yeah, we'd love to have everybody show up and have an anti-10A level of zero, but that's probably not good clinical practice either. So figuring out where we want to aim for, is it 0.2? Personally, clinically right now, when I send a level and it comes back less than 0.1, which is the most specific number we're going to get unless it's zero, anything between zero and 0.1, our lab just says it's less than 0.1, I feel pretty comfortable. Now, if the patient has really no risk associated or very minimal risk associated with the general anesthetic, I might forego an interaxial procedure, although I might love doing those for our total hips, total knees, or whatever else. But if I've got a 90-year-old female and she's got some pulmonary disease, she's got COPD or sleep apnea, now all of a sudden I'm probably okay with 0.1 or 0.15. So I do think there's a little sliding scale in there. And, I think ASFRA probably will say something along the lines of check the level if you have the ability. We don't know what the right level is, but less than 0.2 is, you know, suggestive of maybe being reasonable at this point, but we don't have enough data. But less than 0.1, you know, I think that number is already out there from Ezra. And, you know, now we just got to figure out if that's acceptable clinically.
Yeah, well, well stated. So it's clear to me that more work is needed to help in decision-making around interventional acute pain management and enoxaparin therapy. What do you two see as the next best steps?
Well, Chris is going to do all the next further research on this.
Are you? You're not retiring too, Daryl, are you?
No.
Okay.
I think one idea that we've kicked around for a little while, and it would probably require multi-center study, is, you know, like I mentioned earlier, some type of way to start to quantify residual blood levels at the time of surgery for enoxaparin and the risk of intraoperative or post-procedural bleeding. That kind of study is just fraught with problems that I still have to wrap my head around, because as everybody knows, we're not great at estimating blood loss to begin with. So we need to come up with a reliable way to say this is the risk of bleeding. DVTs, easy. Neuraxial hematoma, don't want to ever see it, but at least it's kind of an objective endpoint. Bleeding volume during the OR, estimated blood loss, I'm just not sure you probably would need thousands and thousands of patients.
What are your thoughts, Chris? Any what are like the next steps?
I think for me, I was kind of alluding to earlier, is just getting a better handle on the appropriate thresholds on either end. At what point are you really concerned about increased bleeding versus increased risk of DVT, and kind of really honing in that appropriate value so that we can feel confident that if we're checking these levels, that we can make an informed risk-benefit ratio for the patient.
And I would probably add too, though, a little larger sample size study where you could get into some more modeling around some of these risk factors, because I was shocked that the renal failure wasn't an independent predictor of a successful outcome, or not a successful outcome, so to speak. But I think a larger sample size would be great, because you could tease out some of those variables that might be related. But this has been a fascinating discussion, and I'm hoping that some of our policy makers and people involved with the guidelines committee listen to the podcast and read your article as they consider what the best recommendations really are. So it's been great. I want to thank you guys for joining us, and all of you who listened in. So we'll see you next time.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate
it. Thank you, listeners.
Thank you for listening to the Rapham Focus podcast. Original music and production are done by Dan Langa. More information can be found at www.danlanga.com. We hope you'll join us in the future for more discussions with authors published in the Rapham Journal, and you can visit us at www.rapham.org.